My name is Zephyr Throld. You're listening to Frank Prattle. This is a special edition for the Huffington Post. Creative Time Summit, Revolutions in Public Practice, is kicking off this week, October 23rd and 24th, up at the New York Public Library, the main branch. And my special guest today is curator and writer Lars Bang Larson. Hi, how are you?
I'm all right, thanks.
So tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is that you do.
I'm a writer and curator, art historian, or I should say mainly writer and an art historian, sometimes curator. I'm currently involved in a research project, writing my PhD about the psychedelic art and culture of the 1960s in a global or international perspective, so in and outside of the Anglo-American world.
Sounds good. We'll definitely cover some more of that later. But tell us a little bit about what you're going to be presenting at a Creative Times Summit coming up here at the end of the week.
Yeah, my Creative Times Summit spiel is about takes its point of departure in a project by the Spanish artist Lara Almarcegui called El Peso de Sao Paulo, or The Weight of Sao Paulo. It's a conceptual artwork, you might say a post-conceptual artwork, from 2006, where she has calculated the weight of the city of Sao Paulo. So, you know, how much all the asphalt and concrete and glass and wood and stones, etc., etc., of Sao Paulo adds up to. And it turns out that that Sao Paulo weighs in at around 1.2 billion ton.
1.2 billion tons.
So you know, it's on the cosmic scale here, and it's Lara's piece is not exactly a public art project in that sense of the term. It's not a work that takes place in public space or outside of the institutional space, but I'm using it a little opportunistically, perhaps, to talk around of the theme of public practice. Meyer Shapiro, the American art historian, said in the 1930s at some point that the public use of art should work towards the well-being of everyone, and I think that's still, in a very general sense, a characterization that sort of colors our idea of public art or the public use of art. From all the way back from the 1930s to identity-based community activism, for example, which also centers around the notion of well-being for everyone and the public use of art. What I'm trying to address in my Creative Time talk, well, it's rather the public thinking of art, how art can be used for public thinking around art, so that's why
using the Sao Paulo project as
using the Sao Paulo project as my point of departure, because it's to me Lara's Sao Paulo project is interesting because it allows us an outside view of the city, as you might say, because obviously the city, whether it's the creative city or the city of bits or the global city or the projective city, as it's been characterized by sociologists in the recent decades, you know, the city is the general precondition for working with art. But actually, Lara's piece gives us allows us to see the city from the outside and take the long view of it, and even if only in a symbolic sense. But I think that her piece allows us to possibly reimagine the city, and I think that's quite important in the era of, you know, the experience economy and discourses on the creative class and all that, and the art of city making and blah blah blah. So all these ways that notions of creativity and urbanization are being conflated and capitalized. So that's why I think it's interesting with Lara to, you know, break down the city or destroy the city, even if only in our minds, and reimagine it from there.
So, I mean, I used to live in Sao Paulo. I lived there for a year.
Oh, really?
And, yeah. and one of the things that struck me about that city is that, you know, they at the time they said that there were 20,000 people, or 20 million people there, rather.
Yeah.
But one of the things that they also admitted is they don't really know how many people are there, because it's totally in flux. There's, you know,
a big sprawling mega city.
And there's, you know, there's whole tracts of houses of just like little shanty towns that could have a million in them, could have 3 million in them. They don't really know, and nobody can go and count them all, so that they just make these broad guesses about how many people are there.
Yeah.
And that kind of flux I find interesting as well for reimagining a city, because I mean, yeah. you take New York City, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they say, you know, the hard facts are that New York City has 8 million.
Mm.
But you look at the greater metropolitan area, and they say it has almost 30 million.
Yeah.
So what is the real city there? You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, I think just like the state that we live in is also a state of mind, so is the city a state of mind, obviously. And we need to connect that state of mind to the city as a material fact. And as an everyday space, I think. Obviously, Sao Paulo is very different from New York or from Copenhagen, where I'm from, because there might still be more space for informal change, as there was in a city like Copenhagen 40 years ago, maybe even only 30 or 20 years ago. Where there would still be, you know, holes or pockets in the urban landscape where you could do stuff, where artists could cheaply rent a storefront and do something, and where there would be a different sense of time as well. It's not only the available space, but also the available time to work and yeah, develop artistic practice or just everyday life.
So, you know, kind of getting back to these issues of social justice that Creative Time has really based this summit around, I've been interviewing people for a while now about this, and they tend to be split pretty evenly down the fence. You know, some believing that art really doesn't have much of a place in the realm of social justice, that that's more for activists and things like that, and that art can kind of point the way, but it can't do anything specifically itself. And others believing, you know, the opposite, that art really is at the front of that and can help change people's notions of what, you know, is correct in the world, what is right in the world, you know, what social justice is. Now, as far as your own work and ideas concerning social justice and how art operates in that, what do you think?
It's a big question, of course. I'm not entirely sure on which side of the fence I find myself. Maybe I'm sitting on it. well, I think that art is a practice that can never be transparent. So I think that as long as we have ideas about authorship, we have art has all these different representational formats, and it will usually be steeped in institutional policies as well, and ideas about value, etc. All of that is not entirely a bad thing, because that's also, you know, art is also this lack of transparency is also because art is a language, it's a vocabulary on its own, and it can help us. Artistic critique can help us rethink also an issue such as social justice. I think to me art is interesting because of the multiplicity of interests that can be at stake in an art project or in an artwork, that it can combine, you know, fascination, indignation, social analysis in the space of an artwork or in the time frame of an artwork, and that it can make fascination, indignation, analysis interact in new ways. So I think that there should also there should always be a materialist perspective in an artwork. It's not quite an answer to your question, but
it's good though. It's good. You know, and the question's giant, so you know. Yeah. So maybe you can respond to this as well. Many people feel that I've spoken to that, you know, if art is going to be something that actually affects social justice, if it's going to be effective in the realm of changing the actual world around it, that it's going to have to lose its kind of white room, you know, white cube Chelsea ties, that is not changing anything over in that direction. What do you feel about that, about the commercial gallery system and even the university gallery system, you know, that oftentimes funds projects such as, you know, you're working on now or things like that, you know?
Well, in terms of the commercial sector, of course, that's a case in point where the idea of social justice may be confronted with the reality of what art does in our cities, because obviously, when you talk about gentrification, urbanization, then it's the old story of commercial galleries moving into a derelict neighborhood and making it go, how do you say, upmarket, gentrifying it. As a curator, I think my concern is that the commercial sector is takes up too much space in the heads of curators. In a sense, I mean, I don't mind that commercial galleries exist, and I don't necessarily want to subvert them. I wouldn't know where to begin, and also I think we shouldn't totalize the idea of the art market, because there are different markets and markets in different cultural sites as well, so they work in different ways. But when I say that the commercial sphere takes up too much space in the heads of curators, it's that I think I see too many shows where curators haven't been doing their studio visits themselves, but have let it be up to the galleries to do their studio visits for them. In other words, that an artistic career and an artistic signature is only authorized when it's been mediated through a commercial gallery. And it's a problem in the States, I think, but not exclusively, it's certainly also an issue in Europe. I think it's this overlap between curating and the commercial sphere is negative. That's detrimental to curating, because it's lazy curating, simply. And of course, the commercial sphere operates with certain formats of displaying art as well. So we also tend to end up with exhibitions that look in a certain way, or with exhibition architecture that looks in a certain way, for example. So
many people, you know, kind of calling this new trend like laptop curation, you know.
Yeah.
That they'll visit, you know, Mary Boone's website, they'll visit whoever's website, yeah, or Columbia's MFA website, yeah, and then they'll curate a show for, you know, I don't know, Pakistan or something, you know.
No, absolutely. And I think there are, of course there are reasons why people are doing it, why curators organize exhibitions in this way, because, or as far as I know, in the States, you often need gallery funding to help with realizing an artist's project for an exhibition. But in Europe, where there still is state funding in some places, at least, it's not the rule anymore. But when that's the case, where you have a funded museum and you anyway go through the commercial galleries to authorize an artistic signature, I think that's quite deplorable. And I don't want to set up any sort of curatorial code of conduct. I don't want to say that we should only look outside of the commercial galleries, because obviously commercial gallery can also be a great help for an artist. But we have to look in both sides.
So, to shift gears slightly, let's talk a little bit about the psychedelic poster project that you're working on right now? Because this is you know, to be frank, this is something that I've found fascinating since I was, you know, a young teenager, is the realm of psychedelic posters.
Yeah.
You know, my mother was a hippie. We lived out in the woods. She had all kinds of crazy posters all over the house. And that's, you know, what I grew up knowing, you know, to be kind of the world that adults had, you know, was the psychedelic hippie world. And so how did you get interested in the psychedelic poster realm?
So that's how you ended up in Alaska, because your mom dropped out?
Essentially, yes.
No. Well, I should say it's not only psychedelic posters that I'm looking into. It's sort of I'm looking at psychedelic art and psychedelic culture, because obviously the very idea of art would be anathema to many a hippie in the 60s, or to the counterculture. You know, obviously the whole psychedelic revolution and the youth revolt was something that sort of still had its effects in the 80s when I was growing up in Denmark and listening to music, etc. So, you know, it was still very sort of erratic and, you know, promised a lot of things. I'm sort of trying to revisit that promise, that sort of strange promise of the Summer of Love, which is, you know, which has been, you know, co-opted and commercialized endlessly since then. So, but I'm trying to look at it from the point of view of, you know, artistic behavior or aesthetic analysis, if you will, and look at poster art, but also expanded cinema, light shows, etc. So these sort of, you know, artistic or para-artistic forms of expression which existed around the counterculture and in many ways sort of prefigured sort of installation art or existed in a sort of strange conflictive relationship to minimal art, for example, or to pop art at the time. And it's also, you know, the psychedelic is such a loaded term, because it also, you know, it talks about the experience. So there is this, you know, metaphysics, this sort of, you know, religious sort of, this sort of ideological ectoplasm of religion that is sort of floating around it. And that's also interesting to revisit and deconstruct, I think. So, and yeah, if you want the whole story, then I'm sorry. I'm trying to
no, it's good.
I just keep yagging them. I'm trying to look at how it traveled from the States, because I believe that it was essentially an American invention, if you can call it that, inspired by a lot of other sources, of course, but sort of this particular spin that it received from rock music, for example, acid rock, etc., expanded cinema movement. I think that was quite particularly North American, but it was a movement and it was an aesthetics that traveled extremely well. So it was all over the place in no time, whether it was, you know, Australia, Finland, or Latin America.
One of the things you were talking about a little bit earlier was your fascination in your study of light bands, you know, bands that had light shows. In you were talking about in Denmark that they actually created a union for light bands, no?
Yeah, that's right. No, they were in Copenhagen. There was a large number of light groups. I think around 65. Some of the members in the groups were the same, though, but they were doubling in some outfits. But they also had a union. They were unionized in what translates as the Association of Music and Light, which was a kind of booking agency as well. So there were also a number of beat groups. Yeah, so it was quite a vivid scene. And the light groups would have, you know, fantastic names such as King Kong or Tess Catley Poker. So they would perform in concerts and festivals, but also, you know, be-ins and a few of them in churches as well for, you know, psychedelic service, or in prisons too. So and of course, they relate to, you know, the aesthetics of the expanded cinema, but also to the idea of visual music, which is sort of, you know, goes back to the avant-garde, Moholy Nagy, and
maybe further back, like to opera. No.
Oh yeah, no. There's definitely opera in there. Definitely opera. More, yeah. Or the idea of the music of the spheres, you know, the whole Pythagorean tradition there, which is quite heady stuff as well. one of the things I'm looking into is I'd really like to write a chapter about the history of vibes, because, you know, it's such a cliche, the good vibes. But it's also, you know, I'm thinking that it could also be really useful to as a sort of, you know, genealogy. Genealogy sounds so pretentious, but, you know, the genealogy of vibrations, because it's something that it definitely harks back to spiritualism, to occultism, Madame Blavatsky and all that, where vibration was also a major trope or metaphor, like ether was where. Oh, yeah, ether was where vibration took place. So, you know, that was sort of, so this sort of pseudo scientific explanations of life after death and all that, but also it also goes back to utopian socialism, such as Charles Fourier, the French utopianist, who wrote about the phalanxes. So this idea that the ideal constitution of society would be in communes of between 800 and 1200 people, and to Fourier, he had two pedagogical models for upbringing of children in the commune. One was the kitchen, because kids love to hang out in the kitchen and taste things, and they can also help with peeling carrots and stuff. The other was the opera, because children like to act as well. And he said that, you know, every commune should be an opera, because in a society where everybody acts, there is no alienation. So I think that there's also a whole weave of references that go further back than the Art Nouveau poster and all that. So you know, that's, yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks.
My name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to Frank Prattle. This is a special edition for the Huffington Post and for the upcoming Summit for Creative Time. And my name is, once again, Zephyr Thrall. My special guest is Lars Bang Larsen, the writer and curator. We're here at Japanica Restaurant in just south of Union Square. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
By the way, is there a website people can check out your material on?
No, not yet. It's in the making, though, but not yet, I'm afraid.